Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. My guest today is Anand Pandian, a professor of anthropology at Johns Hopkins University, who has written a book in which he makes an intriguing argument about the reasons and roots of the acute political polarity that has gripped our country and many other countries over the past decade or so. Dr. Pandian makes the case that the bifurcated political landscape is a product of the physical makeup of daily American life, from what we drive to where we live and even how we carry ourselves as individuals. Several years ago, Dr. Pandian set out to encounter people whose political perspective differed from his own, to explore what factors were at play with the walls that divide us and how those walls might be dissembled. It's an imaginative exploration of how and why we are isolated from each other and what we can do about it. It's called Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. Anand Pandian joins me here in Studio A. Anand, welcome. It's good to meet you.
Thank you so much. It really is such a pleasure to be here with you today.
So you set out to find people who purposely, you were looking purposely for people who didn't agree with you politically. You went to 12 different states. What were you looking for? What was the sort of the premise of your research as you began working on this book?
It began for me in the run-up to the 2016 election, when I was thinking a lot about the kind of discourse that we saw at that time in the presidential campaign that our current president was running, and all the language about immigration, and in particular this idea of the border wall and the commitment to building a wall as a way of solving the immigration crisis, which clearly stoked so much passion with so many people. There were people chanting that phrase by the thousands in arenas all around the country, and yet for many of us it also felt needlessly cruel and indifferent to the kind of suffering, pain, and often desperation that led people to attempt something like an illegal migration into the United States. I wanted to understand where that passion came from, why it landed with so many people in this country, and how it might help explain where we are both politically and socially. The reality is that I didn't know very many people personally who had those ideas. I didn't know. I could count on one hand the number of people that I knew who were voting for Trump in that election in 2016. I had to confront the fact that I lived in a bubble myself. And if I were to try to understand something like this, I had to take myself out of the bubble that I was in myself and to try to connect with people who were different from me, who had different convictions, different ideas, a different sense of what the country needed and where it was headed, to try to have conversations with them and to try to make sense of how we got here.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I think it's true for folks on both sides of the political spectrum that the bubbles exist. If you're only watching Fox News, if you're only listening to NPR, you're getting a very different view of the world. There's a certain amount of idealism in the animating factors behind, doing this research and writing this book, which I admire. But have to wonder if it's really nothing more than idealism and a pipe dream. I mean, you write that the United States is at a crossroads, and that you're arguing we are poised between a politics of suspicion and retreat and another founded on a more expansive relationship of mutual aid and communal caretaking. Have we ever in the United States in our 250 years had a sense of communal goodwill and communal caretaking? I wonder. I mean, I've thought about that, and I'm maybe the Second World War brought us together. I don't know. What do you think?
It's an important question, and it's definitely one that's worth thinking about comparatively, for sure. Right? If you compare us to other social democracies around the world, other Western social democracies or democratic polities outside the West, certainly you can see basic differences. You might make the case, for example, that individualism and a kind of competitive individualism has roots and a kind of depth of commitment and purchase on the culture of this country that may feel pretty unique. But the reality is, as long as we've had the United States, we have had deep, deep histories and patterns of tremendous inequality, exploitation, dispossession, the fact that so many resources in the country have been with minority populations with greater power than others for so much of this country's history. And what that means isn't simply a kind of mismatch between what some people have and what other people don't have. It also means different ways of being in the world. And the reality is that for as long as you've had this kind of inequality in this country, racial, social, economic, and so on, you've had many, many communities who've had to band together and look after themselves because the state isn't doing it for them in the way that they need. The powers that be in their localities aren't doing it for them in the way that they need. So we have actually longstanding traditions precisely of, I would say, mutual aid, collective caretaking, often led by those in need, for those organizing on their behalf or with their welfare in mind, that represent counter traditions that remain vital, remain essential. We saw it to such a deep degree right here in Baltimore in the years of the pandemic, when you saw at the neighborhood scale, but also at a larger scale, the scale of the city, all these efforts really to look after the most vulnerable among us. And my feeling is that those counter traditions of looking after each other remain a vital resource in this time of great isolation and polarization.
Anand Pandian is an anthropologist on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. His new book is called Something Between Us: The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So you have a really interesting thesis that a big part of this issue and a big dimension that often gets overlooked are what you call the everyday infrastructures of defense and retreat. And you've organized this book into four major sections. You talk about these walls for home, the road, the body, and the mind. And that's a very interesting way. You're not talking about left, right, media, whatever, which is what you tend to hear about when we talk about political polarity. So you're defining the scope of the problem very differently, and I found that fascinating.
Thank you so much for noticing this and for reading the book. That level
I do interest. That occasionally.
Right? I appreciate that. And you're absolutely right. I am trying to get at this problem in a slightly different way. It has to do with the fact that I'm an anthropologist. And what we do for a living is to try to make sense of our social and cultural lives by paying attention to the minutiae of how people live on a daily basis, how they interact with others, the way that that social life is organized, the ideas and everyday habits and commitments that motivate what they do for themselves, for their families, but also for their larger societies. And from that standpoint, when I began to think about that border wall that I was speaking about in particular earlier in this conversation, one thing I began to notice is the many ways in which the fantasy, really, of protecting the United States by sealing off the country as a whole with an impenetrable wall, which is the promise that came again and again in that campaign in 2016.
And a promise that has garnered Mr. Trump 11 million more votes in 2024 than he got back then.
A promise
that this is a promise that is resonating with all sorts of folks.
A promise that continues to galvanize support and to capture people's imaginations. This is what I wanted to understand. And the reality is that our politics are so deeply woven into the ways that we live, how we relate to each other on that daily basis. And what I began to see is that that idea of protecting oneself through a kind of impenetrable barrier at the national level seemed to resonate and echo all of these everyday boundaries that Americans had come to live with and take for granted in their daily lives. I'm thinking about as you said, the space of the home and how our homes have become ever larger and more fortress-like. The automobiles that we drive in this country, the way that SUVs and trucks have captured 80% of the automotive market, and what it means to fall in with a way of traveling around in the world in a kind of armored vehicle. I'm thinking about our ideas of the body and the way in which the very possibility of physical proximity with others comes to feel so tenuous and dangerous.
I was fascinated that you mentioned the tagline, the advertising line for Under Armour, which is, of course, based right here in Baltimore, is "Protect this house."
Absolutely.
You know, we put a T-shirt on.
Absolutely.
Protect this house.
Absolutely. And again, as an anthropologist, I think moments like that are really interesting metaphors, images that capture people's imaginations. Marketing slogans even like that one have a great deal to tell us about the dominant ideas in a society and the notion that you could think of taking care of yourself, your body, as if you were doing it with your house in both levels. There's a certain kind of commitment to protecting the inside as opposed to the outside. And this is the simple thesis of the book. When we talk about political polarization, we're ultimately talking about the line between insiders and outsiders. And it's really easy to think of that primarily in political terms. People like you, people unlike you, people who have the same ideas, people who have different ideas. But what I'm arguing in this book is that our very basic sense of what it means to be inside and what it means to be outside has been magnified and deepened in all kinds of ways because of these habits that we've taken on.
Yeah, and you write a lot about fortification. The homes are fortified. The cars are fortified. You mentioned the SUVs, the trucks, these big, gigantic things. The fact that even, you know, the clothes we wear are in a sense fortifications to protect us. You talk about disease and how immigrants and immigration has been associated by Mr. Trump and others with disease. I mean, and violence and crime and all of these horrible, terrible things that are brought to the shores by people coming in from other places. So let's walk through them one at a time. When it comes to homes, I was surprised that you report that nearly one out of five American homes in a residential community is secured now by community walls or fences. This is according to the U.S. Census. So these gated communities are not every so often, they're almost most of the time. I mean, one out of five, that's a lot.
It is a lot. It is a lot. And that percentage is increasing. And I, for the research for this book, I visited gated communities in Florida, in Arizona. I talked to people in the industry. I talked to gated community security managers in different parts of the country. I went on tours. I was trying to understand what it is that appeals about spaces like that. And one of the ironies in delving into circumstances like that, it applies to the phenomenon of gated communities, but I think it also applies more generally. I think it's commitments to safety, to security, to protection that lead people into spaces like that, that lead people into these larger vehicles that lead us to do a lot of what we do that eventuates in greater circumstances of isolation. But the reality is that signing on to that way of being in the world, paradoxically, can also leave you with much more anxiety. It can leave you with much more uncertainty because you can't spend all your life within those walls. And one of the things that I learned in visiting such places is that there is a certain kind of unease about the outside world, unease about contact with strangers, unease about proximity with people of different backgrounds that can creep in to this kind of culture.
So is it as simple as fear, just fear of safety? If I don't go downtown, I won't get mugged, that kind of mentality?
Well, I certainly think that those fears are there. And in that effort to push beyond the bubbles that I took for granted in my own life I began to change some of my own habits. One thing that we didn't mention earlier when we were talking about these different levels of different kinds of barriers were the walls of the mind, as I call them in the book, and the way in which our media can contribute to that. And so in the effort to sort of open myself up beyond my own customary bubbles, I began listening a lot to conservative talk radio as part of this research beginning in 2016. And it was really striking for me, living in Baltimore, but beginning to listen, to tune in to other channels of communication.
I do too, all the time.
How much discourse there is around the just sort of basal level of danger that comes simply with living in a city like this one, which didn't really correspond to the way that myself, my wife, our kids felt about the neighborhood that we live in the city of Baltimore. So a lot of it is fear. It's the discourses that spread that sense of fear. It's the incessant drumbeat of that messaging, if that's all that you're taking in. But the other side of the argument that I'm also trying to make is that these infrastructures of isolation and separation can deepen that sense of fear, can deepen that sense of anxiety, can deepen that sense of nervousness. And you begin to look for things that confirm the suspicions you have.
Yeah, and there's a financial incentive on behalf of companies and the people building these homes and building security systems. You know, ADT tells you, you know, it's where the line between us and
perdition. You'd remember that I describe a slogan of theirs, which was quite salient in, I think, in 2016.
This is the alarm company we're talking about.
Yeah, ADT, exactly. A line in the sand between your family and an uncertain world. That's something really to think about.
Yeah. Poetic as it may be. it's some kind of doomsday stuff. Yeah. Interesting. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more. Dr. Anand Pandian, we're talking about his latest book, Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. We'll have more with Anand Pandian on the other side of a quick break. So stick around. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, we're going to remember the scholar and activist Brandi Collins Dexter, who died of cancer this month at the age of 44. She was a wonderful friend of our show, and she wrote a provocative and prescient book called Black Skinhead: Reflections on Blackness and Our Political Future, in which he explored the fraying of the alliance between Black voters and the Democratic Party. So we're going to listen to that conversation tomorrow here on Midday. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is the author and anthropologist, Dr. Anand Pandian of Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about his latest book, Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. You are welcome to join us. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. So, Anand, you visited some folks in North Dakota, and it was fascinating to explore the notion that when they developed these neighborhoods, these communities, it was no longer the case that people hung out on their front porch and talk to people as they walk down the street. The houses themselves were constructed to be lived in the back where nobody could see you. And I had never thought of that. My father tells a story when we lived in Kansas City, we were little kids, and Harry Truman had retired from the presidency, and he used to sit on his front porch. This is, you know, back in the day in the 1960s.
Wow.
And people would walk down the street and say, "Hey, Harry, hey, Mr. President." And he would say hi back to them. I mean, you know, just this whole, the whole notion of what the community was and how people communicated was very different. But we have really just literally paid for isolation.
That's an amazing story. first of all. I hadn't heard that, so thank you for sharing it. And this is definitely one thing that I thought a lot about with this book. We live in Baltimore. We live in a neighborhood essentially of row houses. We've got a front porch. We spend a lot of time on it. We spend a lot of time in the front of our house, in our front yard. We have a neighborhood that has that kind of culture where people are out front. There are people walking down the sidewalk all the time. There's an informal culture of saying hello, of greeting people, of at least just nodding your head, even if you don't know who it is that is walking by. I think that does an enormous amount to your sense, not only of your own community, but your sense of where you are in the world. It's really grounding and anchoring to know that you can be among people, only some of whom you know, and enjoy that kind of collective life. A life with strangers, as ultimately our lives are when we live in communities and societies as large and integrated as ours. But sadly, that experience is falling by the wayside.
It's rare.
And one of the things that I learned traveling around the country and talking to people in different parts of the United States, one of the patterns I began to notice is the extent to which people talked about this particular phenomenon of people retreating from the front porch to the living room, but also from the front porch to the back deck. That instead of enjoying a more unrestricted form of social life with people you know who live nearby, but also to a certain extent with those who might just be passing through, people are increasingly opting for a more restricted form of social activity that is with the people that have been invited into that space. It's something that's happened as a matter of habit, but again, as you emphasized a second ago, it's also something that becomes a certain kind of design. Homes all over the United States still have front porches, but I think the experience of those spaces is largely vestigial, it's ornamental, and I encountered in the company of realtors and real estate developers, in Fargo in particular, homes that took this reality seriously, that were designed to let all the light and social engagement and just the sense of being sort of in the sense of being at home in the company of others, really leaving it to the back of the house.
Yeah, this particular neighborhood in North Dakota, the houses didn't even have windows in the front.
Hardly at all. And another thing that really came through in my conversations with a builder there whose homes I was looking at in that particular section of the book was his observation that in some ways the vestibule that used to be such an important feature of the front door, at least in the homes that his multi-generational building company was constructing, the little sort of entry area that you would step into after stepping into the front door had by and large been replaced by the garage. So the garage is now the vestibule. That is to say, the most important opening, front opening of these homes is the garage that people pull into and then the garage door that they enter into the home in. So there are all these questions that then arise about the extent to which you really have any everyday interaction with strangers at all, which can be really consequential when we think about our larger national anxieties around the place of foreigners among us, around the place of strangers among us, and really the xenophobia that's crept into so much of our political discourse.
And if we didn't drive these big cars coming down the road, creating dust and noise and stuff, which also keeps us off the front porch, and if we lived in different situations, you know, multifamily dwellings, if we all had apartments instead of houses, or if we had, you know, neighborhoods that, like the one we live in now, you know, we are row houses, so I can hear my neighbors on either side of me. I don't hear anybody above me because I'm not in an apartment anymore. But do you speculate that it would be different, that the political polarity in the United States could be attenuated to some degree if we just literally lived with each other in a different relational way?
I think there's a lot at stake in the simple question of how to live with each other in the face of disagreement, in the face of tension, even in the face of conflict. there is no social life without a kind of good faith effort to see through those challenges. It's nice to be in the company of people. It isn't always pleasant. But one of the things about being in close proximity with people on a daily basis is that it leads us to figure out how to enter into those accommodations, what you can adjust to. It's not like you're going next door to complain about everything, right? It's not like it's not like you can call the police with every little thing that your neighbor does that might tick you off, right? We have ways of living and letting live when it comes to living side by side with people. Those are habits that we take on, habits of tolerance, of acceptance, but also, I would say, of gratitude. It's a really hot day in Baltimore. And sure, we're grateful that we have that air conditioning right now in our house, but the reality is our row house is also sheltered on both sides by the homes of those who live along us. And so there are all these benefits to living in the proximity of others that I think having a healthy neighborhood and a healthy spirit of neighborliness in that space can really bring into focus.
Anand Pandian's new book is called Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Anand, we got a couple of questions. Clarence wants to know about the walls of the mind. And I promise you, Clarence, we are going to get to that. And we have a call from Jamie, who says on email that public schools are a great way of meeting and engaging communities. A lot of folks, you know, are now designing schools that they're specifically calling community schools. And Jamie goes on to say, what does the author think about the value of public schools? Do we have places, institutions that naturally bring us together? You reference in the book Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, which is a classic in the anthropological canon, about how there were a lot of bowling leagues back in the day, but now people are bowling by themselves, and it's a very different thing to bowl with others than by yourself. How do you see the institutions and the potential for institutions to bring people together?
It's such an important question, and the reality is that the kind of work that I'm talking about in this book, the kind of work that we're talking about in this conversation, isn't something that we can do on our own. We may have the convictions about these ideas. We may feel really keenly the loss of some of these things that you and I have been talking about in this conversation, but because so many of these things are structural, because they're inherited, because they're sedimented, because they're anchored in place by so much of this built infrastructure that we've been talking about a little, unless we have institutional foundations for the cultivation, maintenance, and deepening of a more collective life, all this is going to be really, really difficult work. I think schools are a wonderful example of that. Both of our children now are in Baltimore City public schools. Our son is at Pauley. Our daughter is at Roland Park Elementary Middle right now. And we're very grateful for the kind of community that we've begun to have in those school environments with parents and teachers and others. But also, as you say, other kinds of institutions, you know, the bowling leagues that Putnam famously talked about, but also libraries, which the sociologist Eric Kleinenberg has described as essential social infrastructure in this country, churches as places to come together, but also as places to sustain the possibility of interfaith dialogue, which is something I talk about in the book in different parts. In that chapter on Fargo, for example, that we were speaking of earlier, I am engaged toward the end of that chapter with a Somali American activist who comes to see the importance of building these kinds of bridges between white residents of Fargo and more recent newcomers, immigrants from other places, and sees interfaith dialogues as one way to do that. And he speaks, as I write about in that chapter, about know your neighbor events, know your Muslim neighbor events that allow people again to make connections across those lines of difference. There's an entire chapter about a more expansive imagination of home and belonging that's set, as you know, in the town of Denton in North Texas, the site of a really violent kind of displacement of a prosperous Black community about a century ago, but the site again of many decades of sustained activism for desegregation in the years since, in which people have come together and established different kinds of institutions that are meant to bring people together in new ways. That work is absolutely essential.
Yeah, and Denton, back in the civil rights era in the 1960s, white families, Black families got together with, they had the Denton Interracial family network or something.
The Interreligious Women's Fellowship.
Yeah. And women got together and, you know, white and Black at a time that wasn't happening hardly anywhere. And this is Denton, Texas, we're talking about. But as you say, you know, an entire Black community, a very prosperous one, had been displaced in this little town. So, yeah, there are certainly moments of hope that you elucidate in the book, but you also talked to some white nationalists at a white nationalist rally in Shelbyville, Tennessee. And one of the guys who's actually from Brooklyn, New York, he's not even a Southerner, and all of the, you know, implications that we may have and you know, biases that we may attribute to people from the South. He says there is no living with the other. Just can't be done. When you talk about, and this is to Clarence's point about the mind, you write that walls of the mind anchor the isolated spheres of thinking and imagination that make it so difficult to agree about what's even happening or why it matters. And we talk about that on this show all the time, that we can't stipulate to the facts together, you know, and if you can't do that, where do you go in a conversation? So what is the response to somebody who says, you know, look, can't live with the other, don't want to do it?
Yeah, these are really, really difficult questions. And there are days or weeks when they seem almost insuperable, when you see things being done that fly in the face of what many others would take to be the most basic coordinates of reality or necessity. What do you do? And I don't know that you can always do something. I would say that on the one hand, one thing that was really interesting for me in this process of doing the research for this book, meeting people around the country, often, as we spoke of earlier, folks on the other side of the political spectrum than where I am, or conservative people, meeting people, being in touch with them over many years, and actually seeing their positions change over these years, people who identified themselves as diehard Republicans, for example, a little less than a decade ago, who have now come to a position where they see themselves as politically homeless because that organized political formation doesn't really speak to how they see themselves or how they seek the country. I have many examples of that kind that I talk about in this book, and I think it's important to take that seriously, that despite the real difficulty that we often feel and that we see registered in the news each day, people are thinking and they are changing their minds and they are wrestling with the difficulty of this impasse that we find ourselves in. On the other hand, though, getting back to the specific example that you just mentioned, just because that's possible and just because that sometimes happens doesn't mean it can always happen. And so part of what I was parsing out in the book is the difference between circumstances in which conversation can be enabling of a different kind of mutual understanding, where people are in a more fluid place. They're talking to each other, they're listening to each other, they're building unexpected forms of social understanding or political coalitions that get different kinds of things done. But on the other hand, other circumstances in which people are so fixed on ideas like the one that you shared of that enthusiast or that supporter of a white nationalist politics, that the only work we can do, I think, under such circumstances is to try to understand why those positions are as fixed as they are. There is a value to that as well. Even if you can't change someone's mind or even if you can't come to any mutual understanding, at least getting a sense of why it is that you disagree so deeply, I think that's still edifying and it's still worthwhile and it can still help.
Yeah, it's a first step. Maureen says, I grew up in the deep suburbs where we rarely encountered neighbors. I realized I really craved more interaction. So fast forward, I now live in Baltimore City and I want to mention the delight of alley life. Lots and lots of neighbors interacting, and even though we have a minuscule front yard, we still feel connected. And I do know neighborhoods all around the city where, you know, block parties are normal occurrences and people, you know, watch out for each other. They water their plants when they go on vacation and they take care of the fish and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. That happens. And I just want to just interject very quickly. I know you're going somewhere else with this, but just to say that when we talk about alley life, it's our human neighbors, but it's also our non-human neighbors. Right. All these ideas around neighborliness and who we live beside and the kind of difference that's structured into our life, it applies to people who may be unlike us, but it also applies to all the other species we share our environments with, sometimes for the better, if you think about our migratory bird life, sometimes for the worse, if you think about our rat problem. But the point is, again, like these spaces are spaces in which we wrestle with the fact that we share what is important with us, what is important to us with other beings who are unlike us, and we have to make our peace with them somehow.
Well, I'm happy that we're sharing our little slice of Baltimore with fewer rats than we used to, so that's a good thing.
Let's take
another quick break. Anand Pandian, his latest book is Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. We will continue our conversation after a quick break here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Dr. Anand Pandian. He's a professor of anthropology at Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore. And in his new book, he explores the ways in which the physical makeup of everyday life can divide us. The houses and neighborhoods we live in, the vehicles we drive, even our own bodies can advance isolation and exacerbate political polarity. The book is a very interesting read. It's called Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. You also write about, Anand, about the fact that with the automobile and the houses being so fortified, that there is this tendency, this place to it gives people the space to be very counter communal, and you talk about people in this what you call diesel culture. And these guys who have trucks and stuff, and they spend time at truck shows and races. You went to Iowa, Tennessee, Colorado, a bunch of other places. And the actual physical exhaust that that they can make come out of their cars was a way of their expressing their sort of antisocial behavior, if you will. I mean, here we are in an environment that does not need more pollution, but they are actually fixing up their cars and their trucks to make more exhaust. And they have, you know, bumper stickers that say, you know, FMPG and all that kind of stuff. So there is, with every instinct to bring us together, there is a contingent that's going to say, nope, that is not for me. I'm anti that because this is America and everybody can do what they want.
So the phenomenon that you describe is called coal rolling. It sort of became a thing about a decade ago. Listeners may have heard it described as Prius repellent, even because it was often sort of something that you would see with the earlier electric or hybrid vehicles that we began to see on the streets, people essentially retrofitting diesel trucks to deliberately spew massive amounts of black smoke as a way of thumbing your nose at people who are on the roads in a different way. People who chose to drive smaller cars, people who chose to drive electric cars, cyclists, pedestrians. I talk in that chapter about the way in which this phenomenon became a really common tactic that people who didn't like the Black Lives Matter protests that galvanized the country, that, you know, that were, that took place all over the country in 2020, a lot of those protests were met with people driving by in big diesel trucks and emitting these big black clouds of smoke as a way of harassing those protesters. So there's a certain kind of subculture here that celebrates exhaust, that celebrates fossil fuels, that celebrates even or advertises the idea of a kind of comfort with the deadliness of our roadways, which I try to make sense of in that chapter. But the challenge, the social challenge, again, getting back to some of these themes that we've been talking about in this conversation, a lot of that has to do, I would say, I argue in that chapter, with the difficulty of communicating in the kind of public space that is a roadway when each person is sort of locked in a vehicle of their own. You have your turn signals, you have your brake lights, but what else do you really have? Maybe you've got some bumper stickers, right? But how else are you really talking to each other? In some ways, I would say the pathos of something like coal rolling, it speaks to that countercultural impulse, but it also just speaks to the poverty of those kinds of public spaces. And so that larger section of the book about our roadway culture is, on the one hand, about the rise of these larger vehicles and the effect that they can have on others outside them, but also about the effort to build complete streets, streets that are open to the experience and navigation by vulnerable roadway users, streets that welcome pedestrians and cyclists and children and others.
There's a Complete Streets program here in Baltimore.
Exactly.
Which faces no shortage of opposition, because there's lots of people who say, hey, wait a minute, you know.
And you know what? It's been really amazing to be able to bike all the way from our home in Hamden, Wyman Park, which is where we live, all the way down to the Inner Harbor on bike lanes, which we could do beginning just a couple years ago, thanks to these developments. So what I'm trying to say here is that the goal here isn't to kind of point out certain people and say, oh, you know, you're really awful people, right? Yes, there are things that are happening that are terrible and we've got to document them. And maybe there are subcultures that we find really troubling. But I think we also have to take a step back and ask the question, why does this stuff happen? And I think as long as we have roadways that lock us each into these steel cases, steel and aluminum cases, you're going to have eruptions of one kind or another.
Talk about the Lincoln Highway. I was fascinated by this. This is less than 2 miles of road that was designed to be like the ideal highway in America.
Well, the Lincoln Highway was the first transcontinental roadway built over a century ago in the early years of automotive development in the United States. It was the first roadway that connected the East and West coasts. It was really important. And one of the really interesting things about looking back at the development of the Lincoln Highway over the early decades of the 20th century was the attention that planners gave to the possibility that cars and pedestrians could and should coexist side by side.
Yeah, and so, I actually so there's take a little readers, part of exactly, the Lincoln Highway that they tried to design called, the ultimate way.
Yeah. That called the ideal section. And I go there to that part of it. It connects two towns, I believe, Schererville and Dyer in Indiana. And I walk it today. I talk about the plans for this sort of beautiful landscape road, sort of walkway that would adjoin the highway. But you try to walk it today, there's no sidewalk. You're navigating a forest of signs, not a forest of trees. People are honking at you. Every little business is designed for people like pulling over as a drive-through. So how did that get lost? And what would it mean to try to recover some of those more hopeful moments that might once again give us a sense or a way to build back more of a sense of community in these spaces that we have by necessity to share?
So is the solution or the movement towards consensus and finding ways for us to function in a democracy where there isn't this kind of polarization? Does it hinge on, you know, living in a more communal situation, driving less, taking public transportation, being on a bus where you can have a, you know, an offhand conversation with a stranger? Deborah writes an email saying that the schools really are important because when you have children in public schools, they meet people from different socioeconomic groups. And when you attend the events, you become friends with the neighbors who also have children there. You
absolutely
get to know them through your kids. And that happens. Any parent will tell you that that absolutely happens. Is it the way we're educating our kids, the way we're driving, or the way we're transporting ourselves, the way we're living, the places we're living? Is if all of those things change, do the politics change?
You know, I'd like to think that it would have an effect. It may take a long time for us to see those changes and the hopefulness in that imagination realized, but I do think that we would see differences because part of what I try to do in the book is to show some of those stories, to show that happening, to show the way that people, as you said, in this North Texas town called Denton came together to organize across racial lines, organizing together, but also occupying public space in a different way to make other forms of collective life possible in that town. I talk about environmental justice movements here in Baltimore, but also in the Hudson River Valley, who have zeroed in on the shared necessity that all of us have for clean water as a way of making the case for a broader kind of awareness. I talk about everyday habits of attention and awareness that people can give each other with that kind of, with that sense of a broader life that we in fact share. All of these things matter. It matters what we do on an individual basis. It matters the attitudes and expectations, the possible openness that we bring to those encounters matters a great deal. But the reality is that it can't just be up to us as individuals. There are structural factors at work. We need our spaces to look different. We need investments of another kind. We need a kind of physical reconstruction of our isolating infrastructure if we're to effectively deal with these problems. And the only way to get there is to organize for those outcomes, to join together with other people who have those commitments and make visible the fact that we feel that this is necessary and that it can take us somewhere else in this country.
Anand Pandian, his latest book is Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. Anand Pandian will be speaking about the book at the Ivy Bookshop next month on Thursday night, August 21st. That's Thursday, the 21st of August at 6 o'clock. Anand, I really appreciate your writing this very, very thought-provoking book and coming by and chatting about it. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been great to talk to you.